On the wind roared toward Tar Valon, gaining strength as it went, shrieking over military camps near the river where soldiers and camp followers sleeping on the ground suddenly had their blankets stripped off, and those in tents awoke to canvas jerking and sometimes whipping away into the darkness as tent pegs gave way or guy ropes snapped. Laden wagons rocked and toppled, and banners stood out stiff before they were uprooted, their hurtling staffs now spears that pierced whatever lay in their path. Leaning against the gale, men struggled to the horse lines to calm animals that reared and screamed in fear. None knew what the Aes Sedai knew, yet the biting sulphurous smell that filled the chill night air seemed an ill omen, and hardened men offered their prayers aloud as fervently as the beardless boys. Camp followers added their own, and loudly armorers and farriers and fletchers, wives and laundresses and seamstresses, all clutched by the sudden fear that something darker than blackness stalked the night. The fierce flutter of canvas overhead, near to ripping, the babble of voices and the screams of horses, loud enough to cut through the wailing wind, helped Swan Sanchez struggle awake for the second time. The abrupt stink of burning sulfur made her eyes water, and she was grateful for it. Egwene might be able to don and doff sleep like a pair of stockings, but the same was not true for her. Sleep had been hard enough to come by after she finally made herself lie down. Once the news had reached her from the riverbank, she had been sure she never would sleep, short of utter exhaustion. She had offered prayers for Lyanna, but all of their hopes rested on Egwene's shoulders, and all of their hopes seemed gutted and hung up to dry. Well, she had exhausted herself with nerves and worry and pacing. Now there was hope again, and she did not dare let her leaden eyelids close for fear she would sink back into slumber and not wake till midday, if then. The ferocious wind abated, but people's shouts and horses' cries did not. Wearily, she tossed aside her blankets and stood up unsteadily. Her bedding was hardly comfortable, laid out on the canvas groundcloth in a corner of the not very large square tent. Yet she had come here, though it meant riding. Of course she had been near falling down by then, and likely not in her right mind from grief. She touched the twisted ring Turangreal hanging from a leather cord around her neck. Her first waking, every bit as hard as this one, had been to fetch that from her belt pouch. Well, the grief was vanquished now, and that was adequate to keep her moving. A sudden yawn made her jaws creak like rusty oarlocks. Barely adequate. You would have thought Egwene's message— The fact that Egwene was alive to send a message would be enough to banish bone weariness. Not so, it appeared. Channeling a globe of light long enough to see the box lantern on the main tent pole, she lit it with a thread of fire. The single flame gave a very pale, flickering illumination. There were other lamps and lanterns, but Gareth went on so about how little lamp oil there was in stock. The brazier she left unlit. Gareth was not so parsimonious with charcoal as oil. Charcoal was easier come by, but she was barely aware of the frigid air. She frowned at his bedding, still lying untouched on the other side of the tent. He surely was aware of the boat's discovery and who it had carried. The sisters did their best to keep secrets from him, but somehow they succeeded less often than most believed. More than once he had startled her with what he knew. Was he out there in the night organizing his soldiers for whatever the hall decided? Or had he already departed, leaving a lost cause? No longer lost, yet he must be unaware of that. No, she muttered, feeling an odd sense of treachery, that she had cast doubt on the man, even in her own mind. He would still be there at sunrise, and for every sunrise until the hall commanded him to leave, maybe longer. She did not believe he would abandon Egwene, whatever the hall commanded. He was too stubborn, proud. No, it was not that. Gareth Bryn's word was his honor. Once given, he would not take it back unless released, whatever the cost to himself. And maybe, just maybe, he had other reasons to stay. She refused to think of that. Putting Gareth out of her mind, why had she come to his tent? It would have been so much easier to lie down in her own in the sisters' camp, cramped as it was, or even to have kept the weeping chaser company, though on second thought that last might have been beyond her. She could not abide weeping, and Egwene's maid would not stop. Putting Gareth firmly out of her head, she ran a hasty brush through her hair, changed her shift for a fresh one, and dressed as quickly as she could in the dim light. Her plain blue wool riding dress was rumpled and spotted with mud on the hem besides. She had gone down to see the boat for herself, but she did not take the time to clean and press it with the power. She had to hurry. The tent was far from the spacious affair you would have expected of a general, so hurrying meant bumping her hip against a corner of the writing table hard enough that one of the legs almost folded before she could catch it, nearly tripping over the camp stool, the only thing approaching a chair, and barking her shins on the brass-bound chests that lay scattered about. That brought a curse that would have singed any listener's ears. The things served double duty, seats as well as storage, and one with a flat top did for a makeshift washstand with a white pitcher and bowl. In truth, they were arrayed in a neat enough fashion, but one peculiar to him. He could find his way through that maze in pitch dark. Anyone else would break a leg trying to reach his bedding. She supposed he must have a concern for assassins, though he had never voiced it. Gathering her dark cloak from atop one of the chests and folding it over her arm, she paused on the point of snuffing the lantern with a flow of air. For a moment she stared at Gareth's second pair of boots, standing at the foot of his bedding. Channeling another small sphere of light, she moved it close to the boots. As she had thought, freshly blacked. The bloody man insisted she work off her debt, then sneaked in behind her back, or worse, under her nose while she slept, and blacked his own bloody boots. Gareth Bloody Bryn treated her like a maidservant, never so much as tried to kiss her. She jerked upright, her mouth going taut as a mooring rope. Now where had that thought come from? No matter what Egwene claimed, she was not in love with Gareth Bloody Bryn. She was not. She had too much work in front of her to get caught in that kind of foolishness. That's why you stopped wearing embroidery, I suppose, a small voice whispered in the back of her head. All those pretty things stuffed into chests because you're afraid. Afraid? Burn her if she was afraid of him or any man. Carefully channeling earth, fire, and air just so, she laid the weave on the boots. Every last bit of the blacking, and most of the dye as well, came away and formed into a neat, glistening sphere that floated in the air, leaving the leather decidedly gray. For a moment she contemplated depositing the ball among his blankets. That would be a suitable surprise for him when he finally laid down. With a sigh, she pushed open the door flap and took the ball outside into the darkness to let it splash onto the ground. The man had a short and extremely disrespectful way when she let her temper carry her too far, as she had discovered the first time she hit him over the head with the boots she was cleaning, and when he made her so angry she put salt in his tea. Quite a lot of salt. But it had not been her fault he was hurried enough to drain the cup in a gulp. To try to, at any rate. Oh, he never seemed to mind when she shouted, and sometimes he shouted back. Sometimes he just smiled, which was purely infuriating. Yet he had his limits. She could have stopped him with a simple weave of air, of course, but she had her honor as much as he had his, burn him. Anyway, she had to stay close to him. Men said so, and the girl seemed infallible. That was the only reason she had not stuffed a fistful of gold down Gareth Bryn's throat and told him he was paid and be burned. The only reason, besides her own honor, of course. Yawning, she left the dark puddle shining in the cold moonlight. If he stepped in it before it dried and tracked the mess inside, the blame would be his own and none of hers. At least the sulfur smell had faded a little. Her eyes had stopped overflowing, though what she could see was turmoil. This sprawling, night-shrouded camp had never had much order. The rutted streets were straight enough, true, and wide for moving soldiers, but for the rest it had always seemed a haphazard array of tents and rough shelters and stone-lined pits for cook-fires. Now it looked much as if it had been under attack. Collapsed tents lay everywhere, some tossed atop others that still stood, though a good many of those stood askew, and dozens of wagons and carts lay on their sides or upside down. Voices on every side called for help with the injured, of whom there appeared to be a fair number. Men limped along the street in front of Gareth's tent, supported by other men, while several small groups hurried by carrying blankets being used as stretchers. Farther away she could see four blanket-covered shapes on the ground, three attended by kneeling women who rocked back and forth as they keened. She could do nothing for the dead, but she could offer her ability with healing to the others. That was hardly her greatest skill, not very strong at all, though it seemed to have returned to her fully when Nynaeve healed her. Yet she doubted there was another sister anywhere in the camp. They did avoid the soldiers, most of them. Her ability would be better than none. She could, except for the news she carried. It was urgent that it reach the right people as soon as possible. So she closed her ears to the groans and the keens alike, ignored dangling arms and rags clutched to bleeding heads, and hurried to the horse lines on the edge of the camp, where the oddly sweet smell of horse dung was beginning to win over the sulfur. A raw-boned, unshaven fellow with a haggard glare on his dark face tried to rush past her, but she caught his rough coat sleeve. "Saddle me the mildest horse you can find," she told him, "and do it right now." Bella would have done nicely, but she had no notion where among all those animals the stout mare was tied, and no intention of waiting for her to be found. "You want to go riding?" he said incredulously, jerking his sleeve free. "If you own a horse, then saddle it yourself, if you're fool enough to. Me, I've the rest of the night ahead of me in the cold, tending the ones what's hurt themselves, and lucky if at least one don't die." Swan ground her teeth. The imbecile took her for one of the seamstresses. Or one of the wives. For some reason, that seemed worse. She stuck her right fist in front of his face so quickly that he stepped back with a curse, but she shoved her hand close enough to his nose that her great serpent ring had to be the only thing he could see. His eyes crossed, staring at it. "The mildest mount you can find," she said in a flat voice. "But quickly." The ring did the trick. He swallowed, then scratched his head and stared along the horse lines, where every animal seemed to be either stamping or shivering. "Mild," he muttered. "I'll see what I can do, Aes Sedai. Mild." Touching a knuckle to his forehead, he hurried off down the rows of horses, still muttering to himself. Swan did a little muttering herself as she paced, three strides this way and three that. Snow trampled to slush and frozen again crunched under her stout shoes. From what she could see, it might take him hours to find anything that would not pitch her off if it heard a grunter jump. Swinging her cloak around her shoulders, she shoved the small silver circle pin in place with an impatient jab, nearly stabbing her own thumb. Afraid, was she? She would show Gareth bloody, bloody Bryn! Back and forth, back and forth. Perhaps she should walk the whole long way. It would be unpleasant, but better than being dumped from the saddle and maybe breaking bones in the bargain. She never mounted a horse, including Bella, without thinking of broken bones. But the fellow returned with a dark mare bearing a high-cantled saddle. "She's mild?" Swan demanded skeptically. The animal was stepping as though ready to dance, and looked sleek. That was supposed to indicate speed. "Night Lily here's meek as milk water, Aes Sedai. Belongs to my wife, and Amaris is on the delicate side. She don't like a mount what gets frisky." "If you say so," she replied, and sniffed. Horses were seldom meek in her experience. But there was nothing for it. Taking the reins, she clambered awkwardly into the saddle, then had to shift so she was not sitting on her cloak and half strangling herself every time she moved. The mare did dance, however she sawed the reins. She'd been sure it would, trying to break her bones already. A boat now! With one oar or two, a boat went where you wanted and stopped when you wanted, unless you were a complete fool about tides and currents and winds. But horses possessed brains, however small, and that meant they might take it into their minds to ignore bridle and reins and what the rider wanted. That had to be considered when you had to straddle a bloody horse.
"One thing, Aes Sedai," the man said as she was trying to find a comfortable seat.
Why did saddles always seem harder than wood?
"I'd keep her to a walk tonight, was I you. That wind, you know, and all that stink, well, she might be just a touch."
"No time," Swan said, and dug her heels in. Mika's milk-water Night Lily leaped ahead so fast that she nearly pitched backward over the cantle. Only a quick grab at the pommel kept her in the saddle. She thought the fellow shouted something after her, but she could not be certain. What in the light did this Namaris consider a frisky horse? The mare sped out of the camp as though trying to win a race, sped toward the falling moon and dragon mount, a dark spike rising against the starry sky. Cloak billowing behind, Swan made no effort to slow her, rather digging in her heels again and slapping the mare's neck with the reins as she had seen others do to urge speed. She had to reach the sisters before anybody did something irretrievable. All too many possibilities came to mind. The mare galloped past small thickets and tiny hamlets and sprawling farms with their stone-walled pastures and fields. Snug beneath snow-covered slate roofs, behind walls of stone or brick, the inhabitants had not been roused by that fierce wind. Every building lay dark and still. Even the bloody cows and sheep were probably enjoying a good night's sleep. Farmers always had cows and sheep. And pigs. Bouncing around on the hard leather of the saddle, she tried leaning forward over the mare's neck. That was how it was done. She had seen it. Almost immediately she lost the left stirrup and nearly slid off on that side, barely clawing her way back to get her foot back in place. The only thing to do was sit bolt upright, one hand clutching the pommel in a death grip, the other tighter still on the reins. Her flailing cloak tugged uncomfortably against her throat, and she jounced up and down so hard that her teeth clicked if she opened her mouth at the wrong time, but she hung on, and even heeled the animal once more. Ah, light, but she was going to be bruised within an inch of her life come sunrise. On through the night, smacking the saddle with the mare's every bounding stride. At least her clenched teeth kept her from yawning. At last the horse lines and rows of wagons that ringed the Aes Sedai camp appeared out of the darkness through a thin rim of trees, and with a sigh of relief she hauled back on the reins as hard as she could. For a horse moving this fast, surely it required hard hauling to stop. Night Lily did stop, so abruptly that she would have hurtled over its head if the mare had not reared at the same time. Wide-eyed, she clung to the animal's neck until it finally settled all four hooves to the ground again, and for some little time after as well. Night Lily was breathing hard, too, she realized. Panting, really. She felt no sympathy. The fool animal had tried to kill her just the way horses would. Recovering herself took a moment, but then she pulled her cloak straight, gathered the reins, and rode past the wagons and the long lines of horses at a sedate walk. Shadowy men moved in the darkness along the horse lines, doubtless grooms and farriers seeing to the visibly unsettled animals. The mare seemed more biddable now. Really, this was not too bad at all. As she entered the camp proper, she hesitated only a moment before embracing Sayadaw. Strange to think of a camp full of Aes Sedai as dangerous, yet two sisters had been murdered here. Considering the circumstances of their deaths, it seemed unlikely that holding the power would be enough to save her if she was the next target, but Sayadaw at least gave an illusion of safety, so long as she remembered it was only illusion. After a moment she wove the flows of spirit that would hide her ability and the glow of the power. There was no need to advertise, after all. Even at this hour, with the moon low in the west, there were a few people out on the wooden walkways, serving women and workmen, scurrying about late tasks. Or perhaps early would be a better word now. Most of the tents, in nearly every size and shape imaginable, were dark, but a number of the larger ones glowed with the light of lamps or candles. Unsurprising under the circumstances. Every lit tent had men around it or gathered in front. Warders. No one else could stand so still they seemed to fade into the night, especially not in this icy night. With the power filling her, she could make out others, their warders' cloaks making them vanish in the shadows. Between the murdered sisters and what their bonds to their Aes Sedai must be carrying to them, not surprising at all. She suspected more than one sister was ready to tear her own hair, or someone else's. They took note of her, heads swiveling to follow her passage as she rode slowly along the frozen ruts, searching. The hall had to be informed, of course, but others needed to hear first. In her estimation, they were much more likely to do something precipitate, and quite possibly disastrous. Oaths held them, but oaths given under duress— to a woman they now believed dead. For the hall, for most of the hall, they had nailed their flag to the mast in accepting a seat. None of them would be jumping until they were very, very sure where they would land. Shiriam's tent was too small for what she was sure she would find, and dark besides, she noted in passing. She very much doubted the woman was asleep inside, though. Morvryn's, big enough to sleep four comfortably, would have done if there was room among all the books the Brown had managed to acquire on the march, but that was dark as well. Her third choice provided a catch, though, and she reined in Night Lily well short of it. Mirel had two peaked tents in the camp, one for herself and one for her three warders, the three she dared acknowledge, and her own shone brightly, the shadows of women moving on the patched canvas walls. Three dissimilar men stood on the walkway in front of the tent. Their stillness marked them warders, but she ignored them for the moment. What exactly were they talking about inside? Certain that it was useless effort, she wove air with just a hint of fire. Her weave touched the tent and struck a barrier against eavesdropping. Inverted, of course, and so invisible to her. She had only made the attempt on the chance they were being careless. Small possibility of that with the secrets they had to hide. The shadows against the canvas were still now, so they knew someone had tried. She rode the rest of the way, wondering what they had been talking about. As she dismounted, well, at least she managed to turn half falling off into something akin to jumping down, one of the warders, Shiriam's Arinvar, a lean Kyrianin little taller than she, stepped forward to reach for the reins with a small bow, but she waved him away. Releasing Sidar, she tied the mare to one of the wooden slats of the walkway, using a knot that would have held a sizable boat against heavy winds and a strong current. None of those casual loops that others used, not for her. She might dislike riding, but when she tied a horse, she wanted it there when she came back. Arinvar's eyebrows climbed as he watched her finish the knot, but he would not be the one who had to pay for the bloody animal if it got loose and lost itself. Only one of the other two warders belonged to Mirel. Eivar Hachami, a Saldaean with a nose like an eagle's beak and thick gray-streaked mustaches. After sparing her one glance and a slight inclination of his head, he returned to watching the night. Morvryn's jury, short and bald and nearly as wide as he was tall, did not acknowledge her at all. His eyes studied the darkness, and his hand rested lightly on his long sword hilt. Supposedly he was among the best of the warders with a blade. Where were the others? She could not ask, of course, any more than she could ask who was within. The men would have been shocked to their bones. None of them tried to stop her from entering. At least matters had not gotten that bad. Inside, where two braziers gave off the scent of roses and made the air almost toasty compared to the night, she found almost everyone she had hoped for, and all watching to see who entered. Mirel herself, sitting on a sturdy straight chair in a silk robe covered with red and yellow flowers, her arms folded beneath her breasts, wore such a perfect expression of calm on her olive face that it only pointed up the heat in her dark eyes. The light of the power shone around her. It was her tent, after all. She would be the one to weave a ward here. Shiriam, seated on one end of Mirel's cot with a straight back, pretended to be adjusting her blue-slashed skirts. Her expression was as fiery as her hair, and it grew hotter when she saw Swan. She was not wearing the keeper's stole, a bad sign. "I might have expected it would be you," Carlenia said coldly, fists on her hips. She was never a warm woman, but now the ringlets that stopped well short of her shoulders framed a face that seemed carved from ice nearly as pale as her dress. "I will not have you trying to listen in on my private conversations, Swan." "Oh, yes. They thought everything was at an end." Round-faced Morvryn, for once not appearing at all absent-minded or sleepy-eyed, despite the creases in her brown wool skirt, walked around the small table where a tall silver pitcher and five silver cups sat on a lacquered tray. It seemed no one felt like tea. The cups were all dry. Dipping into her belt pouch, the graying sister thrust a carven horn comb into Swan's hand. "You are all wind-blown, woman. Fix your hair before some lout takes you for a tavern trull instead of an Aes Sedai and tries to dandle you on his knee." "Egwene and Lyanna are alive and prisoners inside the tower," Swan announced, more calmly than she felt. "A tavern trull?" Touching her hair, she discovered that the other woman was right and began working the comb through the tangles. If you wanted to be taken seriously, you could not look as though you had been tussling in an alley. She had enough difficulty with that as it was now, and would have until some years after she could lay hands on the oath rod again.
Egwene spoke to me in my dreams. They succeeded in blocking the harbors near enough, but they were captured. Where are Baenin and Nisau? One of you go fetch them. I don't want to scale the same fish twice. There. If they thought themselves free of their oaths and free of Egwene's orders to obey her, that should disabuse them. Except that no one moved to obey. Baenin wanted her bed, Morvern said slowly, studying Swan. A very intense study. A sharp mind hid behind that placid face. She was too tired to talk any more. And why would we have asked Nisau to join us? That earned a small frown from Mirel, who was Nisau's friend, but the other two nodded agreement. They and Baenin thought of Nisau as apart from themselves, in spite of the oaths of fealty they shared. In Swan's opinion, these women had never stopped believing they might still guide events somehow, even after the rudder had long since been taken from their hands. Shiriam rose from the cot as though about to rush off, even gathering her skirts, but that had nothing to do with Swan's command. Anger had vanished, replaced by shining eagerness. We don't need them for the moment in any case. Prisoners means the deep cells until the hall convenes for a trial. We can travel there and free them before Elida knows what is happening. Mirel gave a sharp nod and stood, reaching to undo the sash of her robe. Best if we leave the warders behind, I think. They won't be needed in this. She drew more deeply on the source, already anticipating. No, Swan said sharply, and winced as the comb caught in her hair. Sometimes she thought of cutting it shorter than Carlinia's, for convenience, but Gareth had complimented her, saying how much he liked the way it brushed her shoulders. Light! Could she not escape the man even here? Egwene isn't to be tried, and she isn't in the deep cells. She wouldn't tell me where she is being held except to say that she is guarded constantly, and she orders that there be no attempt to rescue her that involves sisters. The other women stared at her in shocked silence. In truth, she herself had argued the point with Egwene, to no avail. It had been an order, delivered by the Armelin seat in full fig. What you're saying is irrational, Carlinia said finally. Her tone was still cool, her face serene, but her hands smoothed her embroidered white skirts unnecessarily. If we capture Elida, we will try her and very likely still her. If. Their doubts and fears were not put to rest yet. Since she has Egwene, surely she will do the same. I don't need Baenin to tell me what the law says in that regard. We must rescue her, whatever she wants. Shiriam's voice was hot as Carlinia's was chill, and her green eyes sparkled. Her hands had turned to fists gripping her skirts. She cannot realize the danger she is in. She must be in shock. Did she give you any hints where she's held? Don't try to hide things from us, Swan, Mirel said firmly. Her eyes seemed almost on fire, and she jerked the silk sash tighter for emphasis. Why would she hide where she's being held? For fear of what you and Shiriam suggest. Giving up on the wind-whipped tangles, Swan tossed the comb down on the table. She could not stand there combing her hair and expect them to pay attention. Tousled would have to do. She is guarded, Mirel, by sisters, and they won't give her up easily. If we try a rescue, Aes Sedai will die at the hands of Aes Sedai sure as silver pike spawn in the reeds. It's happened once, but it must not happen again, or all hope dies of reuniting the tower peacefully. We cannot allow it to happen again. So there is to be no rescue. As to why Elida has decided not to try her, I can't say. Egwene had been vague on that, as if she did not understand either, but she had been definite on the facts, and it was not a claim she would make unless she was sure. Peacefully, Shiriam muttered, sinking back onto the cot. She imbued the word with a world of bitterness. Was there ever any chance of that from the beginning? Elida has abolished the Blue Aja. What chance of peace is there?
Elida cannot simply do away with an Aja, Morvern murmured, as though that had anything to do with anything.
She patted Shiriam's shoulder, but the fire-haired woman sullenly shrugged off her plump hand. There is always a chance, Carlinia said. The harbors are blocked, strengthening our position. The negotiators meet every morning.
Trailing off with a troubled look in her eyes, she poured a cup of tea and drank half of it down in one go without adding honey. Blocking the harbors likely would have put an end to the negotiations by itself, not that they had seemed to be going anywhere. Would Elida let them continue with Egwene in her hands besides?
I do not comprehend why Elida would not have Egwene put on trial, Morvryn said, since conviction would be sure and certain, but the fact remains that she is a prisoner.
She displayed none of Shiriam or Mirel's heat and none of Carlinia's coldness. She was simply presenting the facts, with only a slight tightness of her mouth.
If she is not to be tried, then without any doubt she is to be broken. She has proven to be a stronger woman than I took her for at first, but no one is strong enough to resist the White Tower when it decides to break her. We must consider the consequences if we don't get her out before it can.
Swan shook her head. She isn't even going to be birched, Morvryn. I don't understand why either, but she'd hardly tell us to leave her if she thought they were going to torture...
She broke off as the tent flap was pushed open, and Lelaine Akashi stepped in, blue-fringed shawl draped along her arms. Shiriam stood, though she need not have. Lelaine was a sitter, but Shiriam was the keeper. Then again, Lelaine was imposing in blue-slashed velvet despite her slenderness, dignity-made flesh, with an air of authority that seemed greater than ever tonight. Every hair in place, she might have been entering the hall after a sound night's sleep. Smoothly, Swan turned to the table and picked up the pitcher as if in anticipation. That normally would have been her role in this company, to pour tea and speak when her opinion was sought. Perhaps if she remained quiet, Lelaine would be about her business with the others and leave quickly without giving her a second glance. The woman seldom did give her that much.
I thought that horse outside was the same I saw you ride in on, Swan.
Lelaine's gaze ran over the other sisters, each of them absolutely smooth-faced now.
Am I interrupting?
Swan says Egwene is alive,
Shiriam said, as though relating the price of Delta perch on the dockhead.
And Lyanna. Egwene spoke to Swan's dreams. She refuses any attempt at a rescue.
Mirel gave her a sidelong glance, unreadable, but Swan could have boxed her ears. Likely Lelaine would have been the next she sought out, but to tell her in her own way, not spilled out on the wharf like this? Of late, Shiriam had become as flighty as a novice. Pursing her lips, Lelaine directed a look like twin awls at Swan.
Did she know? You really should be wearing your stole, Shiriam.
You are the keeper.
Will you walk with me, Swan? It's been far too long since we had a conversation alone.
With one hand, she drew back the door flap, shifting that penetrating gaze to the other sisters. Shiriam blushed as only a redhead could, brilliantly, and fumbled the narrow blue stole from her belt pouch to lay it across her shoulders. But Mirel and Carlinia met Lelaine's study with level eyes. Morvryn had begun tapping her round chin with a fingertip as though unaware of anyone else. She might well have been. Morvryn was like that. Had Egwene's orders sunk in? Swan had no chance even for a firm look while putting the pitcher down. A suggestion from a sister of Lelaine's standing, sitter or not, was a command to one of Swan's standing. Gathering her cloak and skirts, she went out, murmuring thanks to Lelaine for holding the flap for her. Liked she hoped those fools had listened to what she said. Four warders stood outside now, but one of them was Lelaine's Barin, a copper-skinned stump of a Damani wrapped in a warder cloak that made most of him seem not there. And Eivor had been replaced by another of Mirel's, Nuhel Dromond, a tall, burly man with an Ilianer beard that left his upper lip bare. The man was so still you might have thought him a statue if not for the wisps of mist in front of his nostrils. Arinvar bowed to Lelaine, a quick courtesy, though formal. Nuhel and Jori did not let their vigilance slacken, nor did Barin, for that matter. The knot that secured Night Lily took as long to undo as it had to tie, but Lelaine waited patiently until Swan straightened with the reins in her hands, then set off at a slow pace along the wooden walkway past dark tents. Moon shadows masked her face. She did not embrace the power, so Swan could not either. Trailed by Beryn, Swan walked beside Lelaine, leading the mare, holding her silence. It was the sitter's place to begin, and not only because she was a sitter. Swan fought the urge to bend her neck and so lose the extra inch she had on the other woman. She seldom thought any longer of the time when she had been Amarlin. She had been embraced as Aes Sedai once more, and part of being Aes Sedai meant fitting into your niche among the sisters instinctively. The bloody horse nuzzled at her hand as though it thought itself a pet, and she shifted the reins to her other hand long enough to wipe her fingers on her cloak. Filthy, slobbering beast. Lelaine eyed her sideways, and she felt her cheeks heating. Instinct. Strange friends you have, Swan. I believe some of them were in favor of sending you away when you first appeared in Saladar. Shiriam I might comprehend, though I'd think the fact that she stands so much higher than you now would make for awkwardness. That was the major reason I avoided you myself. To avoid awkwardness. Swan nearly gaped in astonishment. That came very near to talking about what was never to be talked about. Very near. A transgression she would never have expected from this woman. From herself, perhaps. She had fitted herself into her niche, yet she was who she was. But never from Lelaine. I hope you and I can become friends again, Swan. Though I can understand if that proves impossible. This meeting tonight confirms what Phelan told me. Lelaine gave a small laugh and folded her hands at her waist. Oh, don't grimace so, Swan. She didn't betray you, at least not intentionally. She made one slip too many, and I decided to press her, rather hard. Not the way to treat another sister, but then she's really just an accepted until she can be tested and passes. Phelan will make a fine Aes Sedai. She was very reluctant to surrender everything she gave. Just bits and pieces, really, and a few names. But put together with you in that gathering, it gives me a complete picture, I think. I suppose I can let her free of confinement now. She certainly won't think of spying on me again. You and your friends have been very faithful to Egwene, Swan. Can you be as faithful to me? So that was why Phelan had seemed to go into hiding. How many bits and pieces had she revealed while being pressed hard? Phelan did not know everything, yet it would be best to assume that Lelaine did. But assume while revealing nothing unless she herself was pressed hard. Swan stopped dead, drawing herself up. Lelaine halted too, clearly waiting for her to speak. Even with her face half in shadow, that was clear. Swan had to steel herself to confront this woman. Some instincts were buried in the bone for Aes Sedai. I'm faithful to you as a sitter for my Aja, but Egwene Alvir is the Amarlin's seat. So she is. Lelaine's expression remained unruffled, as much as Swan could make out. She spoke in your dreams? Tell me what you know of her situation, Swan. Swan glanced over her shoulder at the stocky warder. Don't mind him, the sitter said. I haven't kept a secret from Beryn in 20 years. In my dreams, Swan agreed. She certainly did not intend to admit that had been only to summon her to Saladar until I ran Riod. She was not supposed to have that ring in her possession. The Hall would take it away if they learned of it. Calmly, outwardly calmly at least, she related what she had told Mirel and the others, and more. But not everything. Not the certainty of betrayal. That had to have come from the Hall itself. No one else had known of the plan to block the harbor except the women involved, though whoever was accountable could not have known they were betraying Egwene, only helping Elida, which was mystery enough. Why would any among them want to help Elida? There had been talk of Elida's secret adherence from the start, yet she herself had long since dismissed the notion. Most assuredly, every Blue fervently wanted Elida pulled down, but until she knew who was responsible, no sitter, not even a Blue, would learn everything. She's calling a sitting of the Hall for tomorrow. No, it would be tonight, now, when last sounds, she finished. Inside the tower, in the Hall of the Tower. Lelaine laughed so hard that she had to brush a tear from her eye. Oh, that is priceless. the hall to sit right under Elida's nose, as it were. I almost wish I could let her know just to see her face. Just as abruptly, she turned serious again. Lelaine had always had a ready laugh when she chose to let it out, but the core of her was always serious. So Egwene thinks the Ajahs may be turning on one another. That hardly seems possible. She's only seen a handful of sisters, you say. Still, it bears looking into the next time in Telaranriod. Perhaps someone can see what they can find in the Ajah quarters instead of concentrating on Elida's study. Swan barely suppressed a wince. She planned to do a little searching in Telaranriod herself. Whenever she went to the tower in the world of dreams, she was a different woman in a different dress every time she turned a corner, but she would have to be even more cautious than usual. Refusing rescue is understandable, I suppose, even laudable. No one wants any more dead sisters. But very risky, Lelaine went on. No trial and not even a birching. What can Elida be playing at? Can she think to make her take up as accepted again? That hardly seems likely. But she gave a small nod, as though considering it. This was heading in a dangerous direction. If sisters convinced themselves they knew where Egwene might be, the chance increased that someone would try to bring her out, Aes Sedai guards or no. Trying at the wrong place could be as risky as at the right one, if not more so. Worse, Lelaine was ignoring something. "Egwene has called the hall to sit," Swan asked acidly. "Will you go?" Reproving silence answered her, and her cheeks grew hot again. Some things were buried in the bone. "Of course I will go," Lelaine said at last. A direct statement, yet there had been a pause. "The entire hall will go. Egwene Alvir is the Ammerlin seat, and we have more than sufficient dream Tarangrial. Perhaps she will explain how she believes she can hold out if Elida orders her broken. I would very much like to hear that." "Then what are you asking me to be faithful to you about?" Instead of answering, Lelaine resumed her slow walk through the moonlight, carefully adjusting her shawl. Beryn followed her, a half-invisible lion in the night. Swan hurried to catch up, tugging Night Lily after her, fending off the fool mare's attempts to nuzzle her hand again. "Egwene Alvir is the lawful Ammerlin seat," Lelaine said finally. "Until she dies, or is stilled. Should either happen, we would be back to Romanda trying for the staff and the stole, and me forestalling her," she snorted. "That woman would be a disaster as bad as Elida. Unfortunately, she had enough support to forestall me as well. We'd be back to that, except that if Egwene dies or is stilled, you and your friends will be as faithful to me as you've been to Egwene, and you will help me gain the Ammerlin seat in spite of Romanda." Swan felt as though her stomach had turned to ice. No blue would have been behind the first betrayal, but one blue, at least, had reason to betray Egwene now. Chapter 2. The Dark One's Touch. Bayonin woke at first light, as was her habit, though little of the dawn trickled into her tent past the closed door flap. Habits were good when they were the right habits. She had taught herself a number over the years. The air inside the tent held a touch of the night's chill, but she left the brazier unlit. She did not intend to remain long. Channeling briefly, she lit a brass lamp, then heated the water in the white glazed pitcher and washed her face at the rickety washstand with its bubbled mirror. Nearly everything in the small round tent was unsteady, from the tiny table to her narrow camp cot, and the only sturdy piece, a low-backed chair, was rude enough to have come from the poorest farm kitchen. She was accustomed to making do, though. Not all of the judgments she had been called on to make had been given in palaces. The meanest hamlet also deserved justice. She had slept in barns and even hovels to make it so. Moving deliberately, she put on the best riding dress she had with her, a plain gray silk that was very well cut, and snug boots that came to her knees, then began brushing her dark golden hair with an ivory-backed hairbrush that had belonged to her mother.
Her reflection in the mirror was slightly distorted. For some reason, that irritated her this morning. Someone scratched at the tent flap, and a man called cheerily in a Mirandian accent,
"Breakfast, I said, I, if it pleases you."
She lowered the brush and opened herself to the source. She had not acquired a personal serving woman, and it often seemed a new face brought every meal, yet she remembered the stout, graying man with the permanent smile who entered at her command, carrying a tray covered with a white cloth.
"Leave it on the table, please, Evan," she said, releasing Sayadar, and was rewarded with a widening of his smile, a deep bow over the tray, and another before he left. Too many sisters forgot the small courtesies to those beneath them. Small courtesies were the lubricant of daily life. Eyeing the tray without enthusiasm, she resumed her brushing, a twice-a-day ritual that she always found soothing. Rather than finding comfort in the brush sliding through her hair this morning, however, she had to make herself complete the full 100 strokes before laying the brush on the washstand beside the matching comb and hand mirror. Once she could have taught the hills patience, yet that had become harder and harder since Saladar, and nearly impossible since Murundi. So she schooled herself to it, as she had schooled herself to go to the White Tower against her mother's stern wishes, schooled herself to accept the tower's discipline along with its teaching. As a girl, she had been headstrong, always aspiring to more. The tower had taught her that you could achieve much if you could control yourself. She prided herself on that ability. Self-control or no self-control, lingering over her breakfast of stewed prunes and bread proved as difficult as completing her ritual with the hairbrush. The prunes had been dried, and perhaps too old to begin with. They had been stewed to mush, and she was sure she had missed a few of the black flecks that decorated the crusty bread. She tried to convince herself that anything that crunched between her teeth was a barley grain or a rye seed. This was not the first time she'd eaten bread containing weevils, yet it was hardly a thing to enjoy. The tea had a strange aftertaste, too, as though that also was beginning to spoil. When she finally replaced the linen cloth over the carved wooden tray, she very nearly sighed. How long before nothing edible remained in the camp? Was the same happening inside Tar Valon? It must be so. The Dark One was touching the world, a thought as bleak as a field of jagged stones. But victory would come. She refused to entertain any other possibility. Young Althor had a great deal to answer for, a very great deal, yet he must achieve that somehow. Somehow. But the Dragon Reborn lay beyond her purview. All she could do was watch events unfold from afar. She had never liked sitting to one side and watching. All this bitter musing was useless. It was time to be moving. She stood up so quickly that her chair toppled over backward, but she left it lying there on the canvas ground cloth. Putting her head out at the door flap, she found Tervail on a stool on the walkway, his dark cloak thrown back, leaning on the scabbarded sword propped between his boots. The sun stood on the horizon, two-thirds of a bright golden ball, yet dark clouds in the other direction, massing around Dragon Mount, suggested more snow before long, or perhaps rain. The sun felt close to warm after the previous night. Either way, with luck, she could be snug indoors soon. Tervail gave a small nod to acknowledge her without stopping what appeared to be an idle study of everyone who moved in his sight. There were none but laborers at the moment, men in rough woolens carrying baskets on their backs, men and women just as roughly clad driving high-wheeled carts laden with bound firewood and sacks of charcoal and water barrels that clattered along the rutted street. At least his scrutiny would have seemed idle to someone lacking the warder bond with him. Her Tervail, he was focused as a drawn arrow. It was only the men he studied, and his gaze lingered on those he did not know personally. With two sisters and a warder dead at the hands of a man who could channel, it seemed beyond possibility there could be two murderers of that sort. Everyone was leery of strange men. Everyone who knew, at least. The news had hardly been shouted abroad. How he thought he might recognize the killer was beyond her unless the man carried a banner, but she would not upbraid or belittle him for trying to perform his duty. Whipcord lean, with a strong nose and a thick scar along his jaw earned in her service, he had been little more than a boy when she found him, cat-quick, and already one of the finest swordsmen in her native Tarabon. And for all the years since, there had never been a moment when he did less. At least 20 times he had saved her life. Quite aside from brigands and footpads too ignorant to recognize an Aes Sedai, the law could be dangerous when one side or the other became desperate not to have the judgment go against them, and often he had spotted the peril before she herself. "Saddle Winterfinch for me and bring your own horse," she told him. "We are going for a little ride." Tervale raised one eyebrow slightly, half glancing in her direction, then attached the scabbard to the right side of his belt and set off down the wooden walkway toward the horse lines, walking very quickly. He never asked unnecessary questions. Perhaps she was more agitated within than she believed. Ducking back inside, she carefully wrapped the hand mirror in a silk scarf woven in a black and white Tyran maze and tucked it into one of the 2 large pockets sewn inside her good gray cloak, along with the hairbrush and comb. Her neatly folded shawl and a small box of intricately carved blackwood went into the other. The box contained a few pieces of jewelry, some that had come down from her mother and the rest from her maternal grandmother. She herself seldom wore jewelry aside from her great serpent ring, yet she always took the box and the brush, comb, and mirror with her when she journeyed, reminders of the women whose memories she loved and honored, and of what they had taught her. Her grandmother, a noted advocate in Tanchico, had infused her with a love for the intricacies of the law, while her mother had demonstrated that it was always possible to better yourself. Advocates rarely became wealthy, though Kolaris certainly had been more than comfortable. Yet despite her disapproval, her daughter Aeldreen had become a merchant and amassed a tidy fortune buying and selling dyes. Yes, it was always possible to better yourself, if you seized the moment when it appeared, as she had when Elida Arroyhan deposed Swan Sanche. Matters since had not gone anywhere near as she had foreseen, of course. Matters seldom did. That was why a wise woman always planned alternative paths. She considered waiting inside for Tervale to return. He could not fetch 2 horses in mere minutes. But now that the time had actually arrived, her last stores of patience seemed to flee. Settling the cloak around her shoulders, she snuffed the lamp with an air of finality. Outside, however, she forced herself to stand in one place rather than pacing along the walkway's rough planks. Pacing would attract eyes, and perhaps some sister who thought she was fearful of being alone. In all truth, she was afraid, a little. When a man could kill you, unseen, undetected, it was most reasonable to be afraid. She did not want company, though. She pulled up her cowl, signaling a desire for privacy, and drew the cloak around her. A gray cat, notch-eared and lean, began stropping himself against her ankles. There were cats all over the camp. They appeared anywhere that Aes Sedai gathered, tame as house pets, however feral they had been before. After a few moments without having his ears scratched, the cat strolled away, as proud as a king, in search of someone who would see to them. He had plenty of candidates. Just moments earlier, there had been only roughly garbed laborers and cart drivers in view, but now the camp began to bustle. Clusters of white-clad novices, the so-called families, scurried along the walkways to reach their classes, held in any tent large enough to accommodate them, or even in the open. Those who hurried by her ceased their childish prattle to offer perfect curtsies in passing. The sight never ceased to amaze her, or to produce anger. A fair number of those children were well into their middle years or older. No few had at least some gray in their hair, and some were grandmothers. Yet they were bending to the ancient routines as well as any girl she'd ever seen come to the tower. And so many! A seemingly endless flood pouring down the streets. How much had the tower lost through its focus on bringing in girls born with the spark and those already on the brink of channeling through their own fumbling while leaving the rest to find their way to Tarvalin as they would or could? How much lost through insisting no girl above 18 could submit to the discipline? Change was nothing she had ever sought. Law and custom ruled an Aes Sedai's life, a bedrock of stability, and some changes, such as these novice families, seemed too radical to go on, but how much had the tower lost?
Sisters glided along the walkways, too, usually in pairs or even threes, usually trailed by their warders. The flow of novices parted around them in ripples of curtsies, ripples made jagged by the stares directed at the sisters who pretended not to notice. Very few of the Aes Sedai lacked the glow of the power around them. Bayanin came close to clicking her tongue in irritation. The novices knew that Anaya and Chiron were dead. There had been no thought of hiding the funeral pyres, but telling them how the two sisters had died would simply have frightened them. The newest, added to the novice book in Murundi, had worn white long enough to be aware that sisters walking about filled with Sayadar was beyond unusual, though. Eventually that alone would frighten them, and to no purpose. The killer seemed unlikely to strike in public, with dozens of sisters about. 5 mounted sisters riding slowly eastward, none carrying the light of Sayadar, caught her eye. Each was followed by a small entourage, generally a secretary, a serving woman, perhaps a serving man as well in case of heavy lifting, and some warders. All rode with their hoods up, but she had no difficulty making out who was who. Varalyn, of her own grey, would have been tall as a man, while Takima the brown was a tiny thing. Saroya's cloak was flamboyant with white embroidery. She must use Sayadar to keep it so sparkling bright. And a pair of warders trailing Faisella marked her as clearly as her brilliant green cloak. Which made the last, wrapped in dark grey, Magla the yellow. What would they find when they reached Darain? Surely not negotiators from the tower, not now. Perhaps they thought they must go through the motions anyway. People frequently continued to go on as they had been after all purpose in it had been lost. That seldom lasted long with Aes Sedai, however.
They hardly seem to be together at all, do they, Bayonin? You might think they just happened to be riding in the same direction.
So much for the cowl providing a modicum of privacy. Luckily, she was practiced at suppressing sighs or anything else that might give away more than she wished. The two sisters who had stopped beside her were much of a height, both small-boned, dark-haired, and brown-eyed, but their resemblance ended. Ashmanila's narrow face with its pointed nose seldom displayed any emotion at all. Her silk dress, slashed with silver, might have come from a tirewoman's hands only moments before, and silver scrollwork decorated the edges of her fur-lined cloak and cowl. Phaedrine's dark wool bore a number of creases, not to mention several stains. Her woolen cloak was unadorned and needed darning, and she frowned much too often as she was doing right then. She might have been pretty without that. An odd pair of friends, the usually unkempt brown, and the grey who paid as much attention to her clothes as to anything else. Bayonin glanced at the departing sitters. They did appear to be riding in the same direction by chance, more than riding together. It was a measure of her upset this morning that she had failed to note that. "Perhaps," she said, turning to face her unwanted visitors, "they are contemplating the consequences of last night. Yes, Ashmanila?" Unwelcome or not, courtesy must be observed. "At least the Amarlin is alive," the other grey replied, "and by what I've been told, she will remain alive and healthy. Her and Lyanna both." Not even Nynaeve's healing of Swan and Lyanna could make anyone speak of stilling with ease. "Alive and a captive, it is better than being beheaded, I suppose, but not a great deal better." When Morvryn woke her to tell her the news, it had been hard to share the brown's excitement. Excitement for Morvryn, at least. The woman had worn a small grin. Bayonin had never considered altering her plans, though. Facts, they must be faced. Egwene was a prisoner, and that was that. "Do you not agree, Phaedrine?" "Of course," the brown replied curtly. Curtly! But that was Phaedrine, always so immersed in whatever had caught her attention that she forgot how she should behave, and she was not done. "But that is not why we sought you. Ashmanila says you have considerable acquaintance with murders." A sudden gust of wind snatched at their cloaks, but Bayonin and Ashmanila caught theirs smoothly. Phaedrine let hers swirl behind her, eyes intent on Bayonin. "Perhaps you have had some thoughts on our murders, Bayonin," Ashmanila said smoothly. "Will you share them with us? Phaedrine and I have been putting our heads together, but we are getting nowhere.
My own experience is more with civil matters. I know that you have gotten to the bottom of a number of unnatural deaths. Of course she had thought on the murders. Was there a sister in the camp who had not? She herself could not have avoided it had she tried. Finding a murderer was a joy, far more satisfying than settling a boundary dispute. It was the most heinous of crimes, the theft of what could never be recovered, all the years that would never be lived, all that might have been done in them. And these were the deaths of Aes Sedai, which surely made it personal for every sister in the camp. She waited for a last covey of white-clad women, too with grey hair, to make their curtsies and hurry on. The number of novices on the walkways was finally beginning to thin out. The cats seemed to be following them. Novices were more free with petting than most sisters. "The man who stabs from greed," she said once the novices were beyond hearing. "The woman who poisons from jealousy, they are one thing. This is quite another altogether. There are two killings, surely by the same man, but well over a week apart. That implies both the patience and the planning. The motive is unclear, yet it seems very unlikely that he chose his victims by chance. Knowing no more of him than the fact that he can channel, you must begin by looking at what ties the victims together. In this case, Anaya and Chiron, they were both Blue Aja. So I ask myself, what connection has the Blue Aja with a man who can channel? The answer comes back, Moiraine Domodred and Randall Thor. And Chiron, she also had contact with him, yes? Phaedrine's frown deepened to near a scowl. You cannot be suggesting he is the killer. Really, she was getting much too far above herself.
No, said Bayonin coolly. I am saying you must follow the connection, which leads to the Ashaman, men who can channel. Men who can channel, who know how to travel. Men who have some reason to fear Aes Sedai, perhaps particular Aes Sedai more than others. A connection is not the proof, she admitted reluctantly, but it is suggestive, yes?
Why would an Ashaman come here twice and each time kill one sister? That sounds as though the killer wanted those two and no others.
Ashmanila shook her head.
How could he know when Anaya and Chiron would be alone? You cannot think he is lurking about disguised as a workman. From all I hear, these Ashaman are far too arrogant for that. To me it seems more likely we have an actual workman who can channel and bears a grudge of some sort.
Bayonin sniffed dismissively. She could feel Tervail approaching. He must have run to be back so soon.
And why would he have waited until now? The last workman they were taken on in Murundi, more than a month ago.
Ashmanila opened her mouth, but Phaedrine darted in, quick as a sparrow snatching a crumb.
He might have only just learned how. A male wilder, as it were. I've overheard workmen talking. As many admire the Ashaman as fear them. I've even heard some say they wish they had the nerve to go to the Black Tower themselves.
The other Grey's left eyebrow twitched, as much as both shooting to her hairline in another woman. The two were friends, yet she could not be pleased with Phaedrine plucking the words from her mouth in that way. All she said, though, was,
"An Ashaman could find him, I'm sure."
Bayonin let herself feel Tervail, waiting only a few paces behind her now. The bond carried a steady flow of unwavering calm and patience as strong as the mountains. How she wished she could draw on that, as she could on his physical strength.
"That is most unlikely to happen, I'm sure you will agree," she said thinly.
Romanda and the others might have stood in favor of this nonsensical alliance with the Black Tower, but from that moment on they had fought like drunken cart drivers over how to implement it, how to word the agreement, how to present it, every single detail torn apart, put back together, and torn apart again. The thing was doomed, thank the light.
"I must go," she told them, and turned to take Winterfinch's reins from Tervail. His tall bay gelding was sleek and powerful and fast, a trained warhorse. Her brown mare was stocky and not fast, yet she had always preferred endurance to speed. Winterfinch could keep going long after taller, supposedly more powerful animals gave up. Putting a foot in the stirrup, she paused with her hands on tall pommel and cantle. "Two sisters dead, Ashmanila, and both blues.
Find sisters who knew them and learn what else they had in common. To locate the murderer, you must follow the connections. I doubt very much they will lead to Asherman, Bayonin. The important thing is that the killer is found, she replied, pulling herself into the saddle, and turned Winterfinch away before the other woman could go on. An abrupt ending, and discourteous, but she had no more wisdom to offer, and time seemed to press down on her now. The sun was clear of the horizon and climbing. After so long, time pressed very hard indeed. The ride to the travelling ground used for departures was short, but near a dozen Aes Sedai were waiting in a line outside the tall canvas wall, some leading horses, some cloakless as if they expected to be indoors before long, and one or two wearing their shawls for some reason. About half were accompanied by warders, several of whom wore their color-shifting cloaks. The one thing the sisters shared was that each shone with the glow of the power. Tervail expressed no surprise at their destination, of course, but more than that, the warder bond continued to carry steady calm. He trusted her. A silvery flash appeared inside the walls, and after sufficient time to count slowly to 30, a pair of greens, who could not make a gateway alone, entered together with four warders leading horses. The custom of privacy already had attached itself to travelling. Unless someone allowed you to see her weave a gateway, trying to learn where she was going was accounted akin to asking direct questions about her business. Bayonin waited patiently on Winterfinch, with Tervail towering over her on hammer. At least the sisters here respected her raised cowl. Or perhaps they had their own reasons for silence. Either way, she did not have to talk with anyone. At this moment, that would have been insupportable. The line in front of her dwindled quickly, and soon enough she and Tervail were dismounting at the head of a much shorter line, only three sisters. He held aside the heavy canvas flap for her to enter first. Hung between tall poles, the wall enclosed a space of nearly 20 paces by 20 where frozen slush covered the ground, an uneven surface marked by footprints and hoofprints atop one another, and scored in the middle by a razor-straight line. Everyone used the middle. The ground glistened faintly, perhaps the beginning of another thaw that would turn it all to slush that might well freeze again. Spring came later here than in Tarabon, but it was on the brink. As soon as Tervail let the canvas fall, she embraced Sidar and wove spirit almost caressingly. This weave fascinated her, a rediscovery of something thought lost forever, and surely the greatest of Egwene Alvir's discoveries. Every time she wove it, she felt a sense of wonder, so familiar as novice and even accepted, that had not come to her since she attained the shawl. Something new and marvelous. The vertical silvery line appeared in front of her, right atop the scoring on the ground, and suddenly became a gap that widened, the view through appearing to rotate until she was faced by a square hole in the air, more than 2 paces by 2, that showed snow-draped oaks with heavy spreading limbs. A light breeze blew through the gateway, rippling her cloak. She had often enjoyed walking in that grove or sitting on one of the low branches for hours reading, though never in snow. Tervail did not recognize it and darted through, sword in hand, tugging hammer behind him, the warhorse's hooves kicking up puffs of snow on the other side. She followed a little more slowly and let the weave dissipate almost reluctantly. It truly was wondrous. She found Tervail looking at what rose above the treetops in the near distance, a thick, pale shaft rearing against the sky. The White Tower. His face was very still, and the bond seemed filled with stillness, too.
I think me you are planning something dangerous, Bayonin.
He still held his blade bared, though lowered now. She laid a hand on his left arm. That should be enough to reassure him. She would never have impeded his sword arm if there was any real danger.
No more dangerous than is ne—
The words trailed off as she saw a woman some 30 paces away, walking slowly toward her through the grove of massive trees. She must have been behind a tree before. An Aes Sedai in a dress of old-fashioned cut, with straight white hair,
held back by a pearl-studded cap of silver wire, and falling to her waist. It could not be. That strong face with its dark, tilted eyes and hooked nose was unmistakable, though. Unmistakable? But Turanine Murdigan had died when Bayanin was accepted. In mid-step, the woman vanished.
What is it?
Tervail spun, his sword coming up, to stare in the direction she had been looking.
What frightened you?
The Dark One. He is touching the world, she said softly. It was impossible. Impossible, but she was not given to delusions or fancies. She had seen what she had seen. Her shiver had nothing to do with standing ankle-deep in snow. Silently she prayed. May the light illumine me all of my days, and may I shelter in the Creator's hand in the sure and certain hope of salvation and rebirth. When she told him about seeing a sister more than 40 years dead, he did not try to dismiss it as hallucination, merely muttered his own prayer half under his breath. She felt no fear in him, though. Plenty in herself, but none in him. The dead could not frighten a man who took each day as his last. He was not so sanguine when she revealed what she intended. Part of it, anyway. She did so, looking into the hand mirror and weaving very carefully. She was not as adept with illusion as she would have liked. The face in the mirror changed as the weave settled on her. It was not a great change, but the face was no longer an Aes Sedai's face, no longer Baenin Marinya's face, just that of a woman who looked vaguely like her, though with much paler hair.
Why do you want to reach Elida?
He demanded suspiciously. Abruptly the bond carried an edge.
You mean to get close to her? Then lower the illusion, yes? She will attack you and— No, Baenin. If it must be done, let me go. There are too many warders in the tower for her to know them all, and she will never expect a warder to attack her. I can put a dagger in her heart before she knows what is happening.
He demonstrated, a short blade appearing in his right hand, quick as lightning. What I do, I must do myself, Tervail. Inverting the illusion and tying it off, she prepared several other weaves, just in case matters went too far awry, inverting them also. Then began another, a very complex weave that she laid on herself. That would hide her ability to channel. She had always wondered why some weaves, such as illusion, could be placed on yourself, while it was impossible to make others, such as healing, touch your own body. When she had asked that question as accepted, Turanine had said in that memorable deep voice,
"As well ask why water is wet and sand dry, child. Put your mind on what is possible rather than why some things are not."
Good advice, yet she never had been able to accept the second part. The dead were walking. May the light illumine me all the days of— She tied off the last weave and removed her great serpent ring, tucking it into her belt pouch. Now she could stand beside any Aes Sedai, unrecognized for what she was. "You have always trusted me to know what is best," she went on. "Do you still?" His face remained as smooth as a sister's, yet the bond brought an instant of shock.
"But of course, Baenin."
"Then take Winterfinch and go into the city. Hire a room at an inn until I come for you." He opened his mouth, but she raised an admonitory hand. "Go, Tervail." She watched him disappear through the trees, leading both horses, then turned to face the tower. The dead were walking. But all that mattered was that she reach Elida. Only that. Gusts of wind rattled the casements set in the windows. The fire on the white marble hearth had warmed the air to the point that moisture condensed on the glass panes and trickled down like raindrops. Seated behind her gilded writing table with her hands calmly folded on the tabletop, Elida d'Auvrinia Royhan, the Watcher of the Seals, the Flame of Tarvalin, the Ammerlin's Seat, kept a smooth face while she listened to the man in front of her rant, shoulders hunched and shaking his fist.
"Did be kept bound and gagged for most of the voyage, confined day and night to a cabin better called a cupboard. For that I demand the captain of that vessel be punished, Elida. More, I do demand an apology from you and from the White Tower, Fortune stab me! The Ammerlin's Seat does no have the right to kidnap kings any longer. The White Tower does no have that right. I do demand...
He was repeating himself again. The man barely paused for breath. It was difficult to keep her attention on him. Her eyes wandered to the bright tapestries on the walls, the neatly arrayed red roses on white plinths in the corners. Tiresome, maintaining outward calm while enduring this tirade. She wanted to stand up and slap him. The audacity of the man, to speak so to the Ammerlin's Seat. But enduring calmly served her purpose better. She would let him exhaust himself. Matin Stepanaeus den Balgar was muscular, and he might have been good-looking when young, but the years had proven unkind. The white beard that left his upper lip bare was neatly trimmed, but the hair had retreated from most of his scalp. His nose had been broken more than once, and his scowl deepened creases on his flushed face that needed no deepening. His green silk coat, embroidered on the sleeves with the golden bees of Ilion, had been brushed and cleaned well, short of a sister channeling to do the work. Yet it had been his only coat for the voyage, and not all the stains had come out. The ship carrying him had been slow, arriving late the day before, but for once she was not displeased with someone else's slowness. The light only knew what a mess Alviarin would have made of matters had he arrived in a timely fashion. The woman deserved to go to the headsman for the mire she had driven the tower into, a mire Elida now had to dig out of, much less for daring to blackmail the Ammerlin's Seat. Matin Stepanaeus cut off abruptly, taking half a step back on the patterned Tarabonner carpet. Elida wiped the frown from her face. Thinking of Alviarin always made her glare unless she was careful. "Your rooms are comfortable enough for you," she said into the silence. "The serving men are suitable." He blinked at the sudden change of direction.
"The rooms do be comfortable and the serving men suitable," he replied in a much milder tone, perhaps remembering her frown. "Even so, I..."
"You should be grateful to the tower, Matin Stepanaeus, and to me. Randall Thor took Ilion only days after you departed the city. He took the laurel crown as well. The Crown of Swords, he named it. Can you believe he would have faltered in cutting off your head to take it? I knew you would not leave voluntarily. I saved your life. There. He should believe it had been done with his best interests at heart now." The fool had the temerity to snort and fold his arms across his chest.
"I am no toothless old hound yet, mother. I did face death defending Ilion many times. Do you believe I fear dying so much I would rather be your guest for the rest of my life?"
Still, that was the first time he had given her her proper title since entering the room.